From deep in the Swedish forest, the only individualist radio program in Europe, this is VSI Radio International. Something you are told does not make sense, it's usually not true. Finding that life is very straightforward, for those with a lick of sense, this is the voice of the sovereign individual. My name is Paul Lambert. Despite many claims to the contrary, and the cliché notwithstanding, life is generally not very complicated. Most everything we do and everything we encounter is rather straightforward, if we're going to be honest about it. There are things that happen to us that are upsetting. There are tasks we need to do that are difficult. At times, we have difficult decisions to make and even face dilemmas. We are placed in positions of making a choice in which all options available will have negative consequences. Sure, plenty of situations are hard, but if examined honestly and objectively, there are few, if any, situations in life that are actually complicated. Offhand, I cannot even think of a highly contrived hypothetical situation that might be complicated. Quite on the contrary. Instead, those people encountering such a situation can make it complicated by trying to assimilate wrong information, contradictory premises, or by having a reluctance, conscious or subconscious, toward facing unpleasant facts, or having an unwillingness to face the truth. Thus, it is not the situation that's complicated, but the person addressing the situation, who is being unnecessarily complicated. Of course, I should give you an example. About 4 years ago, I paid a visit to a friend in Germany. I, in turn, met a lady friend of his who came from Poland but was living in Germany with her boyfriend. For some reason, the first day we met, she decided to tell me about her personal relationship problems with the boyfriend and that she did not know what to do, whether she should break it off or not. I asked her, if she was not happy, why not break it off? There was going to be heartache no matter what, might as well get it over with. Her answer, of course, was, it's complicated. Now, I only knew her for one day, but I could immediately tell you exactly what her situation was, and you might have guessed already. Having come from Poland and having started a new life in Germany, if she were to break it off with a boyfriend, she'd be left without a place to stay or any means of support and may even need to return to Poland, which she did not want to do. She liked Germany more than she liked the boyfriend and was not sure what she wanted to decide. That's not complicated. She quite simply did not like the very plain and clear choices available to her, and I figured out immediately. You should not be satisfied with the notion that any given situation is complicated. If you find that something is complicated, that usually means that one of your premises is mistaken. You may be mistaken in fact, and then have to deal with an irreconcilable contradiction. There may be a conflict of interests, but you refuse to allow yourself to believe that no consensus is possible. Supposedly complicated situations may also arise from a moral failing on one's own part, trying desperately to rationalize a wrongdoing or an unwillingness to judge between right and wrong. What is complicated in all these cases is not the situation, but the contorted logic behind trying to mangle metaphysical reality and make a bunch of contradictions fit together. Intuition is an interesting psychological concept. It is defined roughly as an ability to gain knowledge without inference, conscious deduction, or reason. It's said that women are more intuitive than men, but I'm not sure it's really a matter of sex. Indeed, I'm not sure that intuition is really all that mysterious. There are plenty of things we learn over time that at first are very tedious and meticulous, but which then become second nature. When first learning to read, we very carefully consider each letter in how they form words, and then each word as it comes together with other words to form sentences. By the time we're adults, we read printed texts quite rapidly and make sense of the information presented without consciously considering each and every letter. Such is the same pattern of learning when taking up juggling or playing the piano. It's a very mechanical process at first, but then it becomes very natural with time. The same is likely true for intuition, and depending on how well intuition is learned, it will be more or less correct. Someone in the habit of thinking rationally, not harboring superstitions and overcoming any phobias he might have, will tend to find that his intuition is more often correct than not. Intuition is something that can be honed in, fine-tuned. Basically, it involves developing a sense of sensibility. After having consistently practiced rational thought in a very deliberate way for a long time, you end up getting a sense for what is often known as the ring of truth. Without having to analyze them consciously, some things you are told will just not sit well with you upon first hearing it. In time, if you do get a chance to examine the matter closely, you will often find that your intuitions were correct. For instance, do you ever get the sense that the news media are not telling you the whole story? Even if you are utterly unfamiliar with the facts of the story being presented, do you ever get the sense that something is just not right? Well, that stems from your intuition. That is, if you have a well-developed sense of sensibility. Not everyone has that. You will meet people who do not hold a single serious opinion of their own. Every single idea they express is taken verbatim from the mainstream media. They attempt to pass off parrot calls as real understanding. Nothing to them seems either plausible or implausible on the surface. They have no ear for the ring of truth. They have no intuition. Now, I would like to be able to say that freedom is on the rise and that there is nobody trying to stop it. Clearly, that's not the case. In European countries, there are serious voices that are openly opposed to freedom of choice. There was considerable opposition to lifting the monopoly on drugstores or the lifting of the monopoly on the postal services and rail travel business, and lifting the government monopoly on radio and television broadcasting. As today, there's opposition to lifting the monopoly on the sale of alcohol and to lifting the ban against homeschooling, and there is considerable pressure to close the nominally private charter schools. And as for allowing people to opt out of government-run social insurance schemes, that's completely out of the question. And how come? In all these cases, freeing such markets would result in different people making different choices, including choices that the powers that be do not want people to make. People will choose wrong. That is literally how the enemies of freedom think. The more socialistic of those expressing such sentiments openly hold that there is a value in a commonality of experience, as they might put it. That there's a value in all children receiving the same education, all patients receiving the same level of care, and even all consumers of television and radio programming having a common viewing and listening experience. In short, the enemies of freedom of choice, do not like the fact that different people will indeed make different choices, hold different opinions, have different consequences. To the political left, socialism in particular, freedom of choice stands in the way of their ideal of monotonous and identical social experience among all people. And quite frankly, they're right. Freedom of choice will invariably lead to different people making different decisions, resulting in very different outcomes. So then, with that in mind, does the mainstream media explanation, shared by power-hungry politicians everywhere, concerning the housing and banking crisis of a few years ago, really make sense? The talking heads were quick to place blame on the banks, and more importantly, that it was a lack of government regulation and an unfettered free market that resulted in such a financial disaster, and that a whole new set of regulations needed to be put in place. Then French President Nicolas Sarkozy was even so blunt as to say that laissez-faire was dead. Clearly, just like in the Great Depression of the 1930s, freedom was blamed for the recent Great Recession. Remember now, the fundamental objection that the left has against freedom is that not everyone is going to make the same choices, and certainly not the choices that the left thinks people should make. With that in mind, does it make sense that in a context of unfettered freedom on the housing and banking markets, every single party involved all chose freely to make all the same mistakes, all in the same industry, and all at the same time? So, without even having to pick apart or dig into the history of this crisis in particular, someone with a fine-tuned sense of intuition will, when told that an unregulated market, that a free market is to blame for such a widespread, universal, and simultaneous crisis, he will find that such an accusation does not have a ring of truth. Certainly, many people will have an emotional stake in believing that. This would include those on the political left, or more generally, those who support government involvement in the economy. The occurrence of this crisis would serve as a kind of confirmation for one's own preconceived notions, and I suppose it's natural for all of us to be prone to such a confirmation bias. So, if we're under the impression that bankers are greedy, and that greed is a terribly dangerous thing, it sits well with us to blame greedy bankers for causing so many people so much misery. Now, it's not my intention to address the global financial crisis in detail in this broadcast, but if you yourself are inclined to consider or perhaps reconsider it in terms of the question of whether or not it was the result of freedom and not due to government controls, consider a few things. Freddie and Fannie were government-sponsored programs created to shore up mortgage debt and, in an immediate sense, allow more and more people to get mortgages, thus eliminating an important risk and loss aspect that is necessary to maintaining an impetus for caution. At all levels of government, federal, state, and local, both banking and housing are among the most highly regulated industries. Looking back to 1977, just before the implementation of the so-called Community Reinvestment Act, the pundits at the time noticed the fact that not every single person with a dollar in his wallet and a smile on his face could get a mortgage, and that at that time, this was held to be proof that capitalism did not work. Thanks to widespread societal attention deficit disorder fostered by mainstream news and media in general, you may forget that during the Carter administration, the Community Reinvestment Act forced lenders to extend risky mortgages that they would not freely have chosen to make. There is the rub of the left again. Freedom means that people might not choose to do what others think they should do. By the time of the reign of Emperor Clintonius the Kinky and his wife Empress Hilarious, the act was given more teeth under Attorney General Janet Reno, who threatened legal sanctions against lending institutions whose racial statistics raised her suspicions of bigotry or discrimination. Banks were forced to abandon such supposedly outdated criteria when judging the creditworthiness of potential borrowers, such archaic indicators such as income, employment history, credit history, minimum down payments. Such carried on into the Bush years, and his policy, the American Dream Down Payment Assistance Act, fit well with his rather reckless vision of what he called an ownership society. Now, these are just a few of the elements to consider. You may or may not find them compelling in themselves, but when these elements are worked into an overall framework of your understanding of the current financial crisis, I think it lends a greater ring of truth to the situation. Of course, that's not everything, and lest I be misunderstood, I personally don't let the banks off the hook altogether. It would sit well with me and reinforce my own confirmation bias, too, if I could lay all the blame squarely on the shoulders of that sniveling mediocrity, Barney Frank. However, anything that Barney Frank may have done to contribute to the crisis simply comes down from a very long line of government intervention measures enacted by both Democratic and Republican administrations. Make of that whatever you will. However, I cannot see how an honest appraisal can arrive at the conclusion that the recent global financial crisis is a result of unfettered, laissez-faire capitalism without any blame being attributable to the state. That just does not have the ring of truth. Of course, truth as such is not a value to the left. I should make it clear what I mean. I did cause a bit of a stir in the past when I said that I found that libertarianism lacks a moral element to it, which is why I cannot call myself libertarian. So, but let me hasten to add that I do not mean that libertarians, as such, are immoral people. Not at all. In fact, every self-described libertarian I've met had a very strong and committed sense of personal morality. But in every case, he saw morality as something separate from his overall politics and as being highly personal and subjective. So I found that libertarianism, as a body of thought, lacks a moral dimension, while libertarians can, and in my experience, are always very moral people. So when I say that the truth is not of value to leftism, I'm not calling every leftist a liar, nor do I deny that there are liars, cheaters, and dishonest people in general that can be found on the right, in the center, and all points in between. I simply mean that when it comes to pushing an agenda or supporting any leftist end, the truth is simply disposed of if it gets in the way. Thus, as environmentalism is a value to the left, nothing that might be contrary to its outlandish claims is considered. And I'm not even talking about climate gates or the oft-repeated claims that 97% of scientists agree with the environmentalists concerning what is now called climate change and no longer global warming. I mean the simple fact that one doomsday prophecy after the next concerning global environmental cataclysm has failed to materialize, but that fact is simply ignored by the left as they hold on to their agenda. The agenda is a value to them. The truth is not. Of course, that did not stop the leftist mainstream media from making a mockery of Harold Camping, who for many years had been a serious Bible scholar, but whose zeal had led him to making reckless claims, to having determined for absolute certain that the world would end in 2011. The left did not resort merely to criticism and objective dissent, but outright ridicule. Whether his goofy predictions deserved ridicule or not, I'll leave you to judge, but my point is that since mocking religion is a value to the left as well, it has no problem making a laughingstock of Harold Camping. And not because he was wrong, but because he is religious. His ideology, his worldview, is contrary to the leftist worldview, and that is why he's ridiculed. In its attempt to destroy religion, the left resorts to polemics and takes one of the more outrageous examples from the religious community and holds that out to be typical. It's not possible to believe that the left ridiculed Camping for being wrong in his prediction, or else it would be just as quick to sling mud at the environmentalists for having been disconfirmed time and time again. But no, environmentalism is a value to the left. The truth is not.
I've just seen a face, I can't forget the time or place where we just met. She's just a girl for me, and I want all the world to see we've met. Had it been another day, I might have looked the other way, and I'd have never been aware. But as it is, I'll dream of her tonight. La-da-da-da-da. Falling, yes, I am falling, and she keeps calling me back again. I have never known the like of this. I've been alone, and I have missed things and kept out of sight. But other girls were never quite like this. La-da-da-da-da. Falling, yes, I'm falling, and she keeps calling me back again. Falling, yes, I'm falling, and she keeps calling me back again. I've just seen her face, I can't forget the time or place where we just met. She's just a girl for me, and I want all the world to see we've met. Na-da-da. Falling, yes, I'm falling, and she keeps calling me back again. Falling, yes, I'm falling, and she keeps calling me back again. Oh, falling, yes, I'm falling, and she keeps calling me back again.
If I might digress for a moment, while Harold Capping at 92 has now retired and closed down the family radio operation by and large, he has offered commentary on the failure of his predictions. Now, in the immediate aftermath of his failed predictions, if aftermath is the right word to use when something does not occur, he offered rationalizations, something to the effect that the spiritual end of the world had occurred, and even if the physical world remained, and other such, well, face it, taurine excreta. However, lately, he has both the humility and presence of mind as an old man to admit that he was wrong. He furthermore holds that he was wrong, perhaps even sinned, in thinking that he could embark on the task of finding some hidden revelation in the scriptures, and he now encourages the faithful simply to read their Bibles for whatever guidance they may get from it. Now, I don't want to say it's never happened, but I do not recall a single instance of a leftist saying he was wrong about anything. No. Being on the left means never having to say you're sorry. As a man of faith, Harold Camping has enough horse sense to reconcile his religious beliefs with a cold, hard reality that he lived to see. Why doesn't the left do the same in the wake of its environmental quackery blowing up in their faces? In facing the reality that there is still plenty of rainforest in Brazil, that a new ice age has not materialized, that England still exists as a country, and that the majority of the population in the United States has not starved to death due to a shortage of food. That's because the truth, inconvenient or not, is not of value to the left. The agenda is. You can keep your insurance plan, period. You can keep your doctor, period. Why say such false things? Well, because if the president told the truth, namely that you would most likely not get to keep your insurance plan or your doctor, he would not have had the same support for his health care act. It's a hierarchy of values. You see, the agenda is a value to the left. The truth is not. Thus, lying in order to advance an agenda is perfectly okay. I suppose this is the same mentality behind the so-called white lie. What, practical lying? Lying for a good cause. An altruistic, I lied not for my sake, but for yours. Of course, lying or deception is a part of warfare, as taught by ancient Chinese military scholar Sun Tzu, who went as far as to say that war is deception. And in spite of its rather anti-military and often pacifistic leanings, the left is always at war with something. There's a war on drugs, a war on poverty, a war on intolerance, a war on inequality, a war on discrimination, a war on homelessness, a war on anorexia. Of course, fighting a war against inanimate objects or even abstract concepts misses the point that in reality, wars are always fought against people. And just like in actual wars, it's always people who get badly hurt. No less in such cases by the left wing in its crusades. All the purported social ills that the left has been fighting as a kind of war in order to stop have only become worse with time. But that inconvenient truth is not worth considering. It's forgotten, since the agenda itself is a higher value than the truth. The ring of truth is never applied to leftist positions, and this becomes problematic when their twisted notions trickle down to the vulgar masses via the left wing's own loyal Praetorian guard and mouthpiece, the mainstream media. People without the sense of being able to detect the ring of truth and to know lies when they hear them cannot truly hold any opinions of their own. Thus, the media forms opinions in the minds of the masses. Quick quiz. Do you know who Adam Peter Lanza was? Think fast. Perhaps you do, and I should give you credit, but I would bet even money that his name does not immediately ring a bell with most listeners. On the other hand, I bet you know what the initials NRA stand for. That's right, the National Roads Authority, essentially the Department of Transportation in the Republic of Ireland. Or perhaps you were thinking of the National Rifle Association. Adam Peter Lanza. What was that that Jennifer Weiner used to say about people who had three names? Yeah, anyway, Mr. Lanza was the perpetrator of the Sandy Hook school shooting. You might remember him now. However, the way the media decided, once again, to milk advantage out of every crisis in the manner it presented the story, you would almost think that the NRA was responsible for the shooting. By the time the media buzz settled, the NRA and any other supporters of the Second Amendment, none of whom were involved in that dreadful crime, were much maligned, while Lanza was made out to be a victim himself. A victim of a poor upbringing, of an irresponsible mother, of mental imbalance. And of course, there was no excuse for the NRA. And of course, once again, consumers of mainstream media had to suffer through weeks of the typical insufferable platitudes of the anti-gun paranoiacs and their demands for blatantly unconstitutional gun control. However, since the perpetrator had taken his own life and there's nobody left to punish, their fingers started pointing to the NRA. Just what is it that the NRA did? Well, it's not at all uncommon to hear mortified news junkies begin to argue, firstly, that such incidents would not happen if guns were illegal. Now, I'll leave that alone for now. Most listeners to this show know better than that, and those who do not cannot be disabused of their ignorance through any effort I'm willing to expend here. I'm not actually upset that many people believe, as an article of faith, that gun control makes sense. What I find frustrating is that so many people think that the NRA is singly to blame for their anti-gun agendas not going through and being legislated. Grown men and women will tell me bluntly that had it not been for the NRA, the Sandy Hook shooting would not have occurred. Furthermore, all sorts of sensible gun control measures could be put into place, but the NRA won't budge on the issue. That stuff screams of mainstream media dissembling. The fact is, it doesn't matter what the NRA will or will not budge on. The NRA is not part of the government, it's not part of the courts, it's not part of law enforcement. The NRA can hold any position it wants, and it has no direct control on gun laws whatsoever. The NRA, at most, is a lobby group, a large and influential one perhaps, but a lobby group all the same, a private club or association made up of private individuals sharing a common interest. Like all lobby groups, they influence legislation by influencing legislators. But that's a symptom of a mixed economy and of unlimited majority rule. Any failing to be found in the corruption of the legislative process is a result of the imperfections already built into this kind of system.
It's coming around again.
You're listening to VSI Radio International. To get in touch with the program, please send an email to feedback@vsiradio.org. That's feedback@victorsierraindiaradio.org. VSI Radio International is produced in Sweden, exclusively for broadcast on WBCQ, transmitting from Monticello, Maine, USA on 7,490 kHz. My name is Paul Lambert. Just a quick announcement before continuing with tonight's monologue. The final episode of VSI Radio International will air on 11 December 2013. It's Wednesday night. I invite all listeners, old and new alike, to take part in that broadcast. You can do so by recording yourself in a short audio file, about 15 seconds in length, in which you can offer greetings to other listeners. You can offer a comment on the show or just say hello. By the time of broadcast, we'll be well into Advent, so if you wish to extend a Christmas greeting to anyone you know who will be listening, or really just to say anything else, please record it as an MP3 file and send it by email to feedback@vsiradio.org. So, mixed economy and majority rule are chapter one in the manual on how the legislative process is corrupted. Of course, leftist narratives always begin on chapter two. When buying and selling are controlled by legislation, the first things to be bought and sold are legislators. P.J. O'Rourke is credited with that, and it really explains everything behind the sordid business of lobbying, though not necessarily made sordid by the lobbyists themselves, but sordid in that so often men must resort to lobbying in order to safeguard their legitimate interests and protect what should often be theirs by right. The political left is always quick to point out the lobbying efforts of all the so-called big institutions, big oil, big tobacco, big finance, big pharma, and lately I've even read of big sugar in its nefarious attempts to stifle legislation concerning food. Of course, the gun lobby is also in the sights of the left. The impression we are left with, thanks to the media, is that such lobbies serving big interests stand in the way of the left's noble agenda and that they sacrifice the good of the people for monetary profit. The matter has been the subject of many investigative journalism reports that have pointed out how large certain lobbies are in Washington and at the state level. And yes, the housing and banking interests are among the largest lobby interests to be found. However, once more, the leftist narrative only begins at chapter two. Housing and banking are the two largest interests exactly because housing and banking are two of the most highly regulated industries in the United States. Legislators are first pressured by voters in general to pass laws, contrary to the principles behind the free market, in order to please the general public who often demand handouts or special concessions for themselves, without regard to the individual rights of the industries providing those very services anyway. Industries whom the left, through the mainstream media and academe, have already been smeared as heartless and greedy, and not deserving of any protection from the vulgar masses and the government. In order to protect their interests against such measures, regulated industries must expend vast amounts of money in order to lobby governments, both to block legislation that would be detrimental to its interests, and, while they're at it, get a few favors for themselves. In history, an American railroad magnate was much maligned for having bought entire legislatures in order to have them pass laws to his liking. Once more, to start the story here, would be to start the story on chapter two. Commodore Vanderbilt had many railroad undertakings underway when all of a sudden one legislative assembly or another would announce a new piece of legislation that was contrary to the principles of free enterprise and which would stifle Vanderbilt's work. He then practically had no choice but to buy entire legislatures in order to protect his legitimate individual rights from overzealous politicians who were making regulations they had no moral right to make. Vanderbilt essentially had to buy permission to create from a body of men who create nothing. Yet, history now remembers Vanderbilt as the villain who bribed his way to riches. So with that in mind, you'll understand that the mixed economy and majority rule does not only invite corruption, but it cannot help but to be corrupt. Corruption is the very foundation of it. Thus, it will furthermore come as no surprise when seeing that the medical industry is also among the most highly regulated industries in the United States, that the medical lobby is consequently one of the largest lobby interests in the United States. Insurance is yet another, and now with Obamacare, or the Affordable Care Act, we can only expect the insurance lobby to become larger. And the left will only tell half the story. As demagogues, the left will cling on to, or even manufacture, some source of popular discontent, be it bad mortgages, or high costs in healthcare and insurance, bank service charges, and yes, even the dubiously named phenomenon of gun violence, and then point to the lobbies as the culprits standing in the way of the left's lofty agendas, when in fact, more often than not, the thing standing in the way of their lofty agendas is the Bill of Rights. The left dominates academia and the mainstream media. As a result, the leftist worldview is the one most commonly presented. And even when the theme of any particular presentation is not particularly political, it cannot help but to reflect the leftist leanings of the authors. Not long ago, there was, and perhaps there still is, a television series showing in the United States called Mad Men. I've never seen it myself, but I've read critiques of it. From what I gather, the show takes place in an office setting in the early 1960s, and it depicts a world in which women were dreadfully mistreated and the male executives were all filled with the stereotypical greed, avarice, and corruption that the left wants us to think of those who lived before us. Now, 1960 doesn't sound like it was that long ago. However, those who were old enough to be senior executives in 1960 would be very old today, and many of them no longer among the living. Hence, there are few people who remember that time who could speak out against such a depiction as being factually inaccurate. Some years ago, there was a very bad movie called The Patriot, starring Steven Seagal, who played a rancher slash veterinarian, possessed of all sorts of flummy ideas about the use of hormones and vaccinations for his cattle, and similar modern, overly sensitive and emotional hero persona that the left wing wants to pass off as masculinity. The Patriot in the film, of course, is a gun-toting militiaman going to measures of extreme violence in order to protect his constitutional rights, and those supporting him are made out to be simple-minded hicks. You see, this is how the left gains power. The people of the United States are not especially enamored by socialism, and if the political left were to present their platform openly and honestly, it's unlikely they would get far. The left gains power by creating a caricature of the right as being possessed with every base and nasty quality known to man, as hotheads who act before they think, as people obsessed with superstition and who are intolerant to difference of opinion. Since that caricature is so often repeated, it becomes ingrained into the minds of people over time until they accept it as true, even in the absence of any evidence or clear example. Remember, too, that the main practical purpose of having elections for political office is really to remove someone you don't like, even more than it is to retain someone you do like. When the American people in particular, and to a lesser but still large extent the people of Europe, vote for the left, they are not hoping for an overtly socialist program. They are simply voting against the caricature of the right. And since the mainstream media is complicit in propagating such deception, the left has free rein to make such stupid comments, such as how the Republican Party stands for racism and that they want children to go hungry. An actor like Sean Penn can speak well of a totalitarian jerk like Hugo Chavez, and Julie Collins of Che Guevara. Jane Fonda can proudly stand on her ground and refuse to criticize socialist governments, and none of these people ever suffer for their comments. They do not become the object of ridicule or derision. The left is held out to be normal, and the right as reactionary and hot-tempered. Some years ago, I was discussing with a friend the tactics used by the left. I pointed out that whenever facing an opponent in a debate, the worst of them resort to ridicule, while even the best of them will tend to change topic and offer distractions. The left cannot stay on topic lest they lose any debates. And that's not because of a failing of rhetoric, or inferior intelligence, or a lack of familiarity of the facts in a discussion. It's quite simply that leftist positions, regardless of anyone who might be supporting them, are objectively, rationally, and factually wrong in and of themselves. They cannot be defended any more than say a position that 2 plus 2 equals 5 can be defended. Actually, let's carry on with that comparison to demonstrate a typical leftist rhetoric. If, hypothetically, a leftist were to put forth that 2 plus 2 indeed equaled 5, you, in response, explained and demonstrated how 2 plus 2 must equal 4. The leftist response might be, why are you so worried? No, wait, sorry, Pacha Empress Hilarious. What difference does it make what 2 and 2 equal when there are people in your district who don't even have two nickels to rub together? You only concentrate on those who already have lots of things. Well, we on the left are concerned about the poor in our district. Sound a bit far-fetched? Well, not really. It's about as unhinged as anyone suddenly calling you a racist in an argument he's losing, in order suddenly to distract you from the matter at hand and then make you defend yourself against the accusation. And since it's very hard to disprove a negative, you'll be seen or heard to lose that discussion. And your audience will come away from the debate remembering only that you have no concern with the poor, not that you can correctly add two and two. The caricature will have been painted. And then in further discussion with my friend concerning left-wing debating tactics, when I suggested that the left resorts to ridicule, he said that the right resorts to guns. Now that's certainly part of the caricature as well, but has the right ever resorted to guns or to violence in general in making its points? Now indeed, I can think of a few cases. Yeah, Timothy McVeigh, the perpetrator behind the Oklahoma City bombing, was arguably a real-life example of the caricature so often painted by the left. I can think of elsewhere in the world, someone like Yigdal Amir, the assassin of Yitzhak Rabin, and a scumbag like Baruch Goldstein, who burst into the Cave of the Patriarchs in Hebron and gunned down and killed dozens of Muslim votaries as they knelt in prayer. And of course, in my own part of the world, two summers ago, there was Anders Behring Breivik, who first bombed a government office in Oslo, killing 8 people and then shot dead 77 kids. These were arguably right-wing people who resorted to violence to put forth their arguments. However, they are the exception that proves the rule, aren't they? And why I say this is because the vast majority on the right were quick to distance themselves from these acts and the men who committed them. The right, by and large, did not make excuses for such wicked behavior and even set politics aside in condemning the actions. The left-wing media, however, did not allow the right to dissociate itself from these anomalous evils. Rather, the left painted everyone holding even a slightly resembling political view to these perpetrators as being complicit in their crimes. The left took every opportunity to capitalize on these atrocities and blamed talk radio, gun ownership, Zionism, religion, anti-immigration sentiment, criticism of Islam, and even freedom of speech. Anyone harboring any of these sentiments were held responsible and tarred with the same brush. The fact that my otherwise intelligent friend would tell me that the right typically resorts to violence to forward their opinion is proof that the caricature was successfully reinforced. Of course, I cannot blame the left via the mainstream media for being quick to make such associations. It needs distraction. The distraction away from the fact that such violence is very atypical of the right, and that the vast majority of political violence, when it occurs, is committed by the left. And never mind the Communist Party in countries like China and Cambodia, North Korea, Russia. Just look to such outfits in the West. The Black Panther Party, the Weather Underground, Bader Meinhof, FLQ, the Symbionese Liberation Army. However, is the left in general tarred with the same brush as these groups? No. And what's more astonishing is the leftist groups will be excused their violence as long as their intentions are good. Leftist causes are defended, typically with the phrase, "I disapprove of violence, but," and then the victim is blamed. This is what passes as normal discourse on the left. There is no behavior so egregious that there is not someone excusing it if the intention behind it is copacetic with the left-wing agenda. Leftists talk about nuances in morality as far as they are concerned. However, what kind of nuance does the left afford the right? Where are the nuances in political correctness? There are none. Every single politically correct value is leftist, Never right or even center. Name a single right-wing value that is considered politically correct. There are none. Then again, by holding themselves out to be the new normal, the left has been destroying the nuances between left, right, and center, and have gone so far as to state that they are the center. The left is in the center, and all opposition is right-wing extremism. But if the left is the center, who's the left of the left? Who in the United States is to the left of Barack Obama? Who's to the left of Hillary Clinton? Who's to the left of Nancy Pelosi? Who's to the left of Jesse Jackson or Al Sharpton or Louis Farrakhan? By dominating academia and the mainstream media, the left has successfully painted a picture of a world that has been instilled in the minds of the wide masses. It's a world in which everything in the past was worse than it is today. It's a world where freedom has had its chance and failed. It's a world in which capitalism is the cause of poverty and socialism the bringer of enlightenment. It's a world in which success only comes by walking over corpses, where self-sacrifice is the only moral action toward one's fellow man. It's a world in which a man like Yasser Arafat was a hero, but Christopher Columbus was a villain, where freedom of speech incites violence and gun ownership makes people commit murder. It's a world where fathers are not needed to help raise children, where marriage is nothing more than a patriarchal affectation, a world where environmental disaster looms right around the corner and that we must lower our living standards. It's a world in which Islam is not a threat to civilization, but religious Christians in the United States are. A world in which it's not important for school children to learn how to read, write, and count, but important to teach them about gender equity and social power differentials. This is the world that the left has made so many of us believe we live in. That world is not real.
Jones, but this running with the Joneses, boy, just ain't where it's at. You're gonna come back around to the sad statue, the dirty Lord down. Got you thinking like that, boy.
The next 2 weeks, VSI will be repeating the two-part documentary on Radio Nord, the offshore radio station broadcasting from the Baltic Sea in the early 1960s. It proved to be a very popular feature in the summer, and now that propagation conditions are much better this time of year, more people will hopefully get a chance to hear it. So thank you for joining me tonight on VSI. Again, please remember that if you would like to send a short audio message to be broadcast on the program on 11 December, to send me your MP3 files by email in the coming week. For now, I wish you all a good night.
If you've enjoyed this presentation, visit www.justrightmedia.org for more programming that's not right-wing, it's just right.